lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding in the damp foggy.
You're listening to episode 509 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show is about the gift economy. I'm going to introduce the topic with a short video based on an article by Beverly Bell published for Yes Magazine, and you can read some more about this at www.otherworldsarepossible.org and look for gift economy in Mali.
Though one of the most cash-poor nations in the world, Mali is rich in many ways. Solidarity, generosity, and care and attention to the whole society, not just one's immediate self and family. Dama is a gift economy, which sustains community and culture, dignity, and values. It is mostly propagated through a strong, though informal, women's social network. It includes most everything. A meal for a hungry neighbor, change for bus fare, a bracelet, all the needs of a woman in her first 40 days after childbirth, sharing the harvest from the fields, or bathing the offspring of another who is off-selling at the market. Dama is not based on exchange or equivalence between giver and receiver. Instead, the receiver passes the gift on to someone else. Gift-giving holds the expectation that just as you provide for others, someone else altogether will care for you or your family. Never just a material object or service, gifts are a pillar of social connections, connecting members directly and indirectly. Passed back and forth, gifts spin webs of relationship and community. Dama sustains and celebrates the value of sharing and is a reflection of what Malians term humanness. In Mali, the cultural norm is to give away as much as possible, with the greatest reverence reserved for generosity. The social pressure towards constant giving discourages people from hoarding for themselves, and so reduces disparity. Malians understand that community is only as strong as its parts. So only by all providing for each other will all survive and thrive. When it works properly, goods circulating in the gift economy can sustain everyone. Dama serves as a social safety net that the state has neglected, such as a working healthcare system, social security for the elders, education, and childcare. Given the damage that the global economy is enacting on all life, the continued strength of the gift economy is imperative for human and cultural survival. The large-scale solidarity and gift economy in Mali continues to resist the market economy as it celebrates the value of life and interdependence, putting human relationships over profit.
I wanted to start with that clip to make the point that gift economy is not just a theory. Gift economy is actually how most countries have worked for most of history and how a lot of countries still do work. Where I live in Bangladesh, life without the gift economy would be unthinkable, even in Dhaka, where money is more important and where the market economy has made the greatest inroads. I'm still impressed by the generosity of ordinary people to strangers, and certainly there is a cultural norm towards giving. There's also a cultural norm towards hoarding. There's a cultural norm celebrates the accumulation of wealth. But these are Western imports, and there is not the expectation that the state is needed to operate things like healthcare systems, police services. Nobody actually expects this to happen. So people are used to providing things themselves, and where they do that, they generally don't feel the need to account, certainly not in terms of money. So I think it is generally the case that the cash-poor nations of the world, as the video puts it, are rich in real terms, such as relationships. We're going to continue our look at the gift economy later in the show with an interview with Alfie Cohn, which questions how important competitiveness is to human nature, and an interview with Genevieve Vaughan, a gift economy activist of many years. And we're going to conclude it with the first part of a presentation by Jeremy Rifkin called The Empathic Civilization. Now another short clip that questions market logic.
The universal assumption of free market enthusiasts is that what essentially drives human beings is a desire to maximize their pleasures, comforts, and material possessions, their utility, and that all significant human interactions can thus be analyzed in market terms. In the beginning, goes the official version, there was barter. People were forced to get what they wanted by directly trading one thing for another. Since this was inconvenient, they eventually invented money as a universal medium of exchange. The invention of further technologies of exchange, like credit, banking, stock exchanges, etc., was simply a logical extension. The problem is there is no reason to believe that a society based on barter has ever existed. Instead, what anthropologists have discovered are societies where most objects moved back and forth as gifts, and almost everything we call economic behavior was based on a pretense of pure generosity and a refusal to calculate exactly who had given what to whom. Such gift economies could, on occasion, become highly competitive, but when they did, it was exactly the opposite way from our own. Instead of vying to see who could accumulate the most, the winners were the ones who managed to give the most away. In some notorious cases, such as the Kwakiutl of British Columbia, this could lead to dramatic contests of generosity, where ambitious chiefs would try to outdo one another by distributing thousands of silver bracelets, Hudson Bay blankets, or Singer sewing machines, and even by destroying wealth, sinking famous heirlooms in the ocean, or setting huge piles of wealth on fire and daring their rivals to do the same. All of this may seem very exotic, but think about this. Why is it that when one receives a gift from a friend, like a drink, a dinner invitation, a compliment, one feels somehow obliged to reciprocate in kind? Why is it that a recipient of generosity often somehow feels reduced if he or she cannot? Are these not examples of universal human feeling which are somehow discounted in our own society? In gift economies, exchanges do not have the impersonal qualities of the capitalist marketplace. In fact, even when objects of great value change hands, what really matters is the relation between the people. Exchange is about creating friendships, or working out rivalries, or obligations, and only incidentally about moving around valuable goods. As a result, Everything becomes personally charged, even property. In gift economies, the most famous objects of wealth, heirloom necklaces, weapons, feather cloaks, always seem to develop personalities of their own. In a market economy, it's exactly the other way around. Transactions are seen simply as ways of getting one's hands on useful things. The personal qualities of buyer and seller should ideally be completely irrelevant. As a consequence, everything, even people, start being treated as if they were things too. Consider in this light the expression, goods and services. In past marketless societies, and in truly human future ones, an economy concerned solely with the creation and distribution of wealth would not even exist. Of course, this goal could not be accomplished right away from our current situation. Intermediate steps would need to be taken. For example, work could be cooperatized, effective social security guaranteed, democratic participatory economics instituted, and gradually a new ethos created whereby the only possible excuse for accumulating wealth would be the ability to give it all away. The result would be a society whose highest values would be the joy of giving in public, the delight in generous artistic creation, and the pleasure of hospitality in public or private events. Of course, economists say that if one takes pleasure in an act of generosity, it is somehow less generous. But if you think about it, I think you'll agree that there isn't any contradiction between what we would call self-interest and a concern for others. And in fact, it's not even clear that the distinction needs to exist. The whole point of the traditional gift is that it furthers both at the same time, establishing the bonds and the collective happiness that are so important for individual well-being. I might add that though Marcel Mauss, David Graeber, and other anthropologists have written mainly about indigenous cultures with gift economies, these have also existed in more modern societies. For example, in place of a market, Spanish anarcho-communists in the 1930s supported a currency-less gift economy in their self-managed villages and distributed their products in community stores, where everyone was entitled to consume whatever they wanted or needed.
On the last point, the speaker conflates the two ideas of wants and needs, which I think needs to be remarked upon, because whilst people in most of the world are quite clear that they have needs, for example, for food, for a place to live, and they have wants, which are not in the same category. Whereas people who've been exposed to a lot of advertising in the rich countries, so-called, may have difficulty working out what are wants and what are needs. People don't actually have a need for foreign holidays, widescreen TVs, and most of the other junk that people seem to think they do have a need for. So why is this important? Well, the current economic system draws no distinction between wants and needs, and has a simple logic that if you have sufficient money to pay for something, then you're entitled to it, and if you don't, then you're not. And as far as I can see, that seems to be a completely psychopathic system that says Africans don't have money, therefore they shouldn't have food, but people in Africa would be well advised to grow flowers for rich people who have a want for flowers which is above the needs of the Africans for food. And how do you gauge that? Well, they have the foreign currency, which is worth so much more. Not to get too far into global economics, but a lot of people in Bangladesh work very hard and can barely satisfy their needs. So a system which can tell the difference between wants and needs and prioritizes needs would seem to me to be a more equitable basis
for an economic system.
Now, as the speaker remarked, in the village, in a local setting, social pressures may suffice. Approximately 1% of people are psychopaths who don't have a conscience and therefore can't understand the perspectives of others, so they will put their wants ahead of anybody else's needs given a chance. Now, in a village, there are social pressures, and if people are behaving like that, they are clearly identified as such, so it's less important for a system to differentiate wants from needs. But on a global basis, if a system can't differentiate wants and needs, then it's open to exploitation by a small number of psychopaths and similarly selfish sociopaths who have taken on those values. Now, you may be wondering at this point, if humans do enjoy giving, and if gift economies are not only possible, but represent most of human history, how it is that the world in which you live seems so far from this. So we're going to have an interview now with Alfie Cohn about how Western culture has embraced competitiveness. And this is about 20 years ago, but I don't think anything much has changed as far as the values that we are encouraged to celebrate. I think perhaps more people are starting to question them as the destructive nature of competition at all costs is becoming clearer and clearer, particularly as far as the natural environment. I would say the social environment as well, but then I've had the experience of living in other cultures and seen how social solidarity hold people together and seen what a blessing social solidarity is, and that life doesn't have to be as competitive as experience in a Western style materialist capitalist society leads people to believe. So here's Alfie Cohn on a program called Open Mind from about 20 years ago.
I'm Richard Heffner, your host on The Open Mind. And for more than just argument's sake, indeed for the sake of the next half hour, I'd like you to consider the following proposition. Life for us has become an endless succession of contests. From the moment the alarm clock rings until sleep overtakes us again, from the time we are toddlers until the day we die, we are busy struggling to outdo others. This is our posture at work and at school, on the playing field, and back at home. It is the common denominator of American life. True or false? True, of course. Good or bad? Well, that's what I want to discuss today with Alfie Cohn, the author of Houghton Mifflin's new book, No Contest, The Case Against Competition. Mr. Cohn begins his book with the paragraph I read and goes on with no holds barred to describe, as he notes, why we lose in our race to win. Indeed, what I suspect must always be the fiercest competition of them all, for the minds of men, Mr. Cohn is no slouch himself. I even watched him on the Phil Donahue show recently, trying to win his point, which he states so well in No Contest. Let me just read another paragraph. Thus it is that Vince Lombardi's famous comment, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing," must be understood not merely as the expression of one football coach's fanaticism, but as a capsule description of our entire culture. Our lives are not merely affected by, but structured upon, the need to be better than. We seem to have reached a point where doing our jobs, educating our children, and even relaxing on the weekends have to take place in the context of a struggle where some must lose. That there might be other ways to do these things is hard for us to imagine, or rather it would be hard if we were sufficiently reflective about our competitiveness to think about alternatives in the first place. Mostly we just accept it as the way life is. Mr. Cohn, isn't life that way?
Well, life in this culture certainly is that way.
From our earliest days, we are trained not only to compete, but to believe in competition, to believe it's necessary for productivity, to believe that it builds character, and even to believe that it's inherent to being human, that it's built into our nature. Life itself doesn't have to be that way. We may be driven innately to achieve, to prosper, to survive, but those don't have to be construed as activities we do against other people, trying to beat them. That is a cultural prejudice, and I know of no other culture which drives the point home in such an exaggerated fashion as our own.
But if you are a cultural determinist, and you seem to be, aren't you spitting against the wind in writing the book and looking at this as the case against competition? How can you possibly establish that case in a culture that functions, as you say, ours does?
Well, I would not describe myself as a cultural determinist. I would suggest that we learn lessons like competition and cooperation rather than having that be a part of our genetic code, for example. There is no evidence for the latter proposition. But I think that all institutions in a given culture can be changed. It was only a generation ago, I think, that we faced what seemed to be an insurmountable barrier toward equality of opportunity for all racism, for all races, rather. Racism seemed to be something that was not only part of our attitudes and personal psychology, but also built into the structures and institutional fabric of the American culture. Slowly we have begun to make progress there, and I argue we can do the same thing with competition. The first step is to understand that what we have been led to believe about competition is false. It is, in fact, counterproductive in the workplace and the classroom. It's psychologically destructive rather than constructive, and it poisons our relationships. If those things are true, if it's undesirable and it's unnecessary, then I think we can begin to make those changes in all arenas where it poisons us.
You say undesirable and unnecessary,
mm-hmm.
But haven't we decided as a people, hasn't our culture decided, isn't it built upon the notion that in terms of economics, it is desirable and it is necessary?
I think in economics, as, for example, in the classroom, we are certainly very competitive, and I'm not sure who the we is. I always get a little...
Should we say they?
Well, I mean, there's a problem whether it's first person or third person about reifying, treating the culture as if it is a single thing, an entity over which we can have no control. Maybe that, in fact, defines a cultural determinist, and that's why I don't put myself in that camp. We can begin to question the assumptions on which competition is based. We are led to believe that people would not be moved to work at all to reach excellence unless they are trying to make other people into losers. The evidence suggests otherwise. We're led to believe that it makes people feel more confident about themselves, that it builds character or enhances self-esteem. Again, the research actually shows us that that's quite wrong. So if we have the capability for reevaluating our behaviors and our attitudes, then we ought to look at what the data actually show, and then we can begin to make changes as parents, as teachers, as managers, as workers.
Yes, but what puzzles me, and I'm not arguing the point with you, but I'm truly curious about this, you seem to take the schoolroom. You take the classroom, you take schools and say, we can make this change. Do you feel the same about competition in the marketplace, where indeed it would seem, in a period, certainly, of limited resources, that if I win in my competition with you, you will lose? Isn't that the basic assumption, and if it is, can it be set aside?
It is the basic assumption of this economic system, yes. I cannot imagine the American economic system as currently defined devoid of competition. If we take the lessons about competition and how unproductive it turns out to be to their logical conclusion, I think it requires some radical rethinking about an economic system. The question is then, do we best produce and distribute resources, and by best I mean not only most productively but most equitably, by having people try to defeat one another? This is no contest, it's not primarily a book about economics, but if you look at the research within the individual workplace in the classroom and see where that evidence seems to lead, I think there's reason to ask some hard questions to suggest the problem may not be simply with an unfair kind of competition, but with competition itself. And I think we need to move toward devising probably small-scale, decentralized cooperative alternatives there, as in the classroom and on the playing field and in the family.
But you say that your book, which I think is an excellent book, and it's extraordinary reading too. I told you before we went on the air that I would compare it with Richard Hofstadter's superb book on social Darwinism in America. But you say, let me also acknowledge that this discussion, intended to raise questions about the fundamental bases of our current economic system, and you make the concession that the book is designed, in part, to raise these questions, does not include a consideration of alternatives. And that's rather difficult for a reader to deal with. For one who would like to accept the notion that one can move to a lessened or a non-competitive system, when you yourself say you have no alternatives to the concept or to the working out of competition in the marketplace.
I don't think I explicitly say I have no alternatives. I go on, I think, in the next sentence or two to mention, albeit briefly, cooperatives in the way that they could work in the smaller scale economic system along the lines perhaps of cooperative farming that is so successful among the kibbutzim in Israel, cooperative, I belong to a food cooperative, for example, and live in a cooperative household. But you're quite right. I only point to those in a very cursory manner. And perhaps the reader will be frustrated in that sense. I hope in a good sense.
What do you mean, good sense?
That the reader will be moved to want more, and perhaps to move him or herself to join with others to devise those alternatives. I think I may be forgiven for not laying out a blueprint for a new society if I've succeeded in showing that the reasons bolstering our current competitive system are in fact fallacious. If that's true, then let's get on together with the next step of the project, which is to devise alternatives.
But of course you're making an assumption that the cause and effect work in one way, and one might make the assumption otherwise. You are saying if we can remove the competitive I win therefore you lose, or you lose therefore I win notion in the classroom and in many other areas of our lives, we'll then be able to move on to the marketplace, to the economic field. But doesn't it seem to be true that we Americans have basically moved in the other direction? We have taken the competitiveness of our economic system and imposed the notion of competitiveness upon our sports, upon our leisure, upon our schools, upon our family life.
Well, there I think it's certainly true that the causal arrow moves in both directions, or rather many directions. Each competitive institution of our society, I think, reinforces each other. One could argue not on the one hand that a competitive economic system is the basis, the model, the prototype, if you will, for the competition that we undergo even on the weekend when we're supposed to be relaxing and having a good time, or for that matter, that the disease of competition, as I put it, is taken home. It's like a bug in the office that somebody brings home, and there it is infecting us in our living rooms and our bedrooms as well, where even there love becomes a kind of trophy. The race for affections becomes a terrible alternative to the family as a refuge from those terrible competitive pressures at work. On the other hand, many have argued that a child learns in the classroom and on the playing field, and for that matter in the family, the lessons that I can succeed only if you fail, which seems to me the kernel, the nub of what it means to compete. And then we go out and transfer that to the public sector, the private sector, that is, what's outside the home. Those arrows move in all directions, and for that reason, I think, we're going to have to be moving on several fronts simultaneously to transcend the competitiveness of this culture. What I would emphasize, though, is that in all of those different arenas, at home, at school, at play, at work, we're going to have to be talking about reconfiguring the institutions, the structures, as opposed to simply transforming the individual consciousness. Many other critics of competition have said that all we have to do is stop caring who wins. Certainly, continue to play competitive games, but don't try to make the other person lose. Or become part of some kind of competitive grading system in the classroom, but don't get carried away with it. That, I think, is where the real problem lies. Not merely one arena versus another, but the notion of the structure versus the individual. Our attitudes are formed, they're modeled, not merely informed, by the structures that point us in certain directions. To say to somebody, to a child, for example, don't care who wins, while playing a competitive game, I think is naive at best and probably hypocritical at worst. What we've got to do is devise ways in which we can enjoy ourselves on the playing field, as well as learn in the classroom and work in the workplace, so that we are working with other people rather than against them. And when I talk of cooperation, let me add, I am not talking about some kind of pie-in-the-sky utopian ideal. I am talking about a shrewd and productive strategy that has been tested. To take the classroom, for example, if you put a bunch of kids together and say that they're going to be graded on the basis of the group performance, you have built in an incentive for each child to want every other one to succeed and to help each other. And the research is absolutely clear. When that happens, kids work better, they learn better, they retain the lessons, they like the subject matter more, and they like each other more than when it becomes a kind of mock battle, which is the major, the dominant model of education in this country now.
Yes, but you say, and I'm fascinated, in no contest. You make it quite clear that you will have no truck with the liberal who says, well, let's just modify this a little bit. You don't like that person because he may co-opt, if I understand correctly, the potential for going all the way. You say that, you just said, that it's naive and hypocritical. How naive or hypocritical would it be for you to say that you think we will make the changes that you advocate?
I don't have a crystal ball. I think that the prediction that none of this could possibly come true, that we could not move beyond competition because it's part of our culture and that's the way life is, tends to be a very powerful statement, really. It tends to be a profoundly conservative notion that I think masquerades as realism. If we all get together and say, with shrugged shoulders, there's nothing you can do, we're competitive and that's the end of it, so you might as well raise another generation on this poison so they'll fit in. If you say nothing can change, that's exactly what will happen.
Suppose we don't say that. Suppose I say, look, nobody's listening, nobody's watching, just between the two of us. What do you really think will happen? Nobody's saying it shouldn't change. It couldn't change. Mm-hmm. It could, it should, it must, but will it? Just between the two of us.
Well, just between the two of us and however many hundreds of thousands of people are listening as well, I think we can say that there is a prospect for change. I do not believe that we are going to be a non-competitive society by next week, and nothing that I've written or say here should be construed to mean that. Do I believe that we can move our classrooms to be cooperative? Do I believe that we can search for cooperative or non-competitive games for our children and ourselves? Do I believe that we can make individual workplaces cooperative? Absolutely. Those are sort of the first stages, I think. And then once that happens and we have children growing up to think of each other as potential collaborators rather than as rivals, rather than as obstacles to their own success, which I think is the tacit lesson of our classrooms and playing fields now, then we can move to the next stage of thinking about political and economic alternatives. So I don't see myself as starry-eyed and unrealistic in predicting that this all can happen with a snap of our fingers.
Yes, yet you've used the word can a number of times. That really isn't what I was asking you. Of course we can. Question that I'm asking you, to the best of your ability, you're not a prophet. You have no crystal ball, but to the best of your ability as a historian, a sociologist, and you are all of these things, will that change take place? Because if your answer is no, don't you have an obligation to look for somewhat different formulations, and perhaps an obligation even to embrace those damn liberals who are constantly co-opting by saying, let's go halfway?
Right. Right. Well, in the last chapter of No Contest, I do not reject the liberal alternative entirely. I distinguish in the book between structural competition, an arrangement that requires us to succeed at the price of someone's failure, and intentional competition, by which I mean a personal desire to be number one. And I think we have the structural kind is the more important, and that's the one that will require the more difficult changes, the ones of transforming our institutions. The liberals, so-called, are the ones who talk more about changing your mindset personally and not caring. And I say that certainly we have to do that as well. So I don't throw out the sort of reformist mentality entirely. Some fine-tuning within the current structure, I think, is necessary. And I'll give you a personal example. An excerpt from my book appeared in Psychology Today in September, which concentrated on the workplace and the classroom and just the evidence of how competition is counterproductive. I got requests for reprints from IBM, Westinghouse, and even the Army there. I was of two minds about that, frankly. I mean, on the one hand, the part of me that said, gather ye rosebuds while you may, said, let us put cooperation into practice on whatever level, on whatever scale is possible now, even given a competitive economic system, and so I was heartened by the interest. On the other hand, and this is the part you've been addressing so far in this program, I have misgivings about that, because certainly my role is not as a corporate consultant to train one corporation to succeed at the price of another one.
Well, that is the point, though, isn't it? That this is a way of succeeding, of knowing what the wave of the future may be.
Yes, but I mean, I guess I resist your question, not because I think the answer is pessimistic or unhappy, but because I think those sort of questions of simply predicting what will happen are not terribly useful. What we can do and should do, I think, are the two more relevant queries here. If competition is something we can change and ought to change, then will follows from that. And it's not merely in my role as a cheerleader to try to set an auspicious circle rather than a vicious circle into motion, but because I believe it's difficult to know. Things change. I don't see society, and I'm sure you as an historian don't either, as simply a pendulum moving between two alternatives back and forth. I think for those who oppose competition and those who favor equity, even in the economic realm alone, find these troublesome times when public officials are urged to simply become cheerleaders for private industry. I'm not convinced that we are moving down some road from which there is no recovery. If you had asked me 30 years ago, had I been in a position to answer the question, which I wasn't, to predict whether women would be in the public sector to the extent they are now, that the New York Times would be using Ms., and that we would have different ways of thinking about women and men in our society, neither I nor I think anyone else could have predicted it will happen.
What an incredibly ameliorist thing to say. I mean, to use something like that as a sign of how possible or likely it is. That I frequently refer to the fact that on this program many, many, many years ago, Max Lerner, we were talking about that point at which Franklin Roosevelt at a press conference was asked by a young cub reporter, was he a socialist? No. Well, was he this? No. Was he that? No. Well, what are you, Mr. President? And he gave an answer that was very, very general. And he said, I'm a Democrat and a Christian. And he was referring to the Judeo-Christian tradition, and he was referring to Democrat with a small d. And I asked Max what he would have said. And Max Lerner said, I'm a possibilist. And I think that is what you are saying. But you use examples, Ms., the role of women today, as if those changes conform at all to that incredibly fundamental, what kind of people are we, or what are we, arena that you address yourself to when you write about playing the human nature card.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that women suffered as they did because of what we said about human nature. I think it had to do with many other things.
I'm not sure I agree with you there. I mean,
you think it was as fundamental.
There are two versions of the human nature argument, the way this is, and I always put it in quotes because I'm always suspicious of it, and the evidence rarely confirms the people who casually say that's just human nature. One version of it is to say that differences among certain humans are innate and built in. And there, I think you found a number of people, and still do, talking about innate differences in cognitive capacities and in orientation toward children versus work and so on, between men and women, or for that matter, between blacks and whites, between Western world and Eastern world. And the second version of the human nature argument is the one that I'm concerned with, and that is that a given characteristic or feature is in fact built in and unavoidable. Those, by the way, tend to be the unsavory elements of our lives here. You know, we are competitive or aggressive or greedy or stubborn or territorial as a matter of human nature. In both cases, the human nature argument is played in order to frustrate change. It certainly has that consequence, even if it doesn't always have that conscious intention. In 4 years of researching this subject for No Contest, I have yet to find a shred of evidence to suggest that we are competitive because we're born that way. The evidence suggests we are trained that way, and what is learned can be unlearned.
Is there anything beyond nurture, in your estimation?
Oh, certainly.
If we play the human nature card now, how do we play it? What do we see? What's the hand that's played?
Well, which characteristics are built into human?
Yeah.
Well, psychologists and biologists differ on this, I think. I think there tends to be a startle response, for example, a desire for belongingness, certainly to have physical needs met. This seems to be built in. I think some kind of love, approval, or acceptance, however that's construed, is something that we're born with. But in order to make a clear-cut statement that this is human nature, I think we necessarily have to talk in such general terms, lest we forget about a culture in which it exists in a very different form, that the whole argument becomes not terribly useful. That's why I think we can spend, even in the case of, say, aggression, you know, it's not as simple as going out and researching a given culture and or looking at the anthropological evidence and saying, I see it all over the place, it's universal, therefore it's inevitable. The burden of proof, and this is the most important point, I think, is on anyone who claims that something is part of human nature to show that it is unavoidable, it always has been, it always will be, and it exists in all cultures. And there certainly is no evidence to that effect, I think, with competition.
But don't you start, as everyone who puts pen to paper starts, with some concept, some notion of what the nature of human nature is, even if you're going to presume a kind of universal tabula rasa?
Well, I suppose you could define that as a kind of, it is human nature to have no human nature. It is certainly within our nature. I want to turn this back to the question of competition, about which I feel I have somewhat more expertise than human nature in general. It is certainly within our nature, within our capability to be competitive, as it is to be cooperative. It is to be generous as it is to be selfish. The question then becomes, if we have that range of potential, which is the most desirable way to go? Which makes more sense for us as individuals and as a society? What I argue here is that it turns out to be counterproductive, that excellence and victory are not only theoretically different, but practically often pull in different directions. To do well is not to be focused on doing better than others. And I also argue that it is, in fact, psychologically disastrous. So far from building character, competition makes us fearful of losing and never satisfied with winning, and we become addicted to competition, needing to prove again and again that we are valuable people because we have beaten others. That's like drinking salt water to quench a thirst. And finally, that it poisons our relationships with each other.
But I'm sure, and we have half a minute left, I'm sure there are many people who still want to relate this to the question of economic success, nationally as well as personally.
Within our culture right now, competition in most sectors seems to be necessary. But I refuse to take that given as a forever given, but rather to talk about how we can reach a less competitive, more healthy, and more productive alternative in economics as elsewhere. I think it can be done. Not much thinking about it has been done so far. It's not as if non-competitive alternatives have been considered and rejected. In this country, I don't think they've been considered seriously at all.
Mr. Cohen, in that great competition, that does go on. This is one of the best books I've ever read. Thank you so much for joining me today on the Open
Mind. Thank you.
If you're living in a Western-style society, I think it's almost certain that you've heard people claim, well, humans are fundamentally competitive. But note that after 4 years of research, Alfie Cohn could find no evidence of this fact, in spite of this widespread belief. Later on in the show, we're going to be hearing from Jeremy Rifkin some evidence to support Alfie Cohn's claim that he thought human nature was fundamentally loving. People needed to have their needs met, but they also needed to belong, and they took joy in nurturing others and meeting their needs. In subsequent shows, we may be exploring Alfie Cohn's idea of what a small-scale, decentralized, cooperative, economic alternative could mean. A few years ago, I was researching into the effects of the money system and profit maximization, which we're told is a productive thing that makes things better for everyone. And I uncovered an example, which I think is a very clear one, of how maximizing profits is destructive. Now, you might think that that's well known. If I asked you, could you name an example where people are rewarded for destroying their own property? That might be harder. I mean, there's plenty of such examples, especially if they're getting subsidies, say, from a common agricultural policy. They're getting paid to dump things. But even without that, there's perfectly logical and rational reasons within the current economic framework why you might wish to destroy or damage your own property. When Intel were making a computer chip, that's the 486SX, a subgrade computer chip, not top of the range, how did they make it? They made it by making a top of the range CPU and then overvolting it. They put too much electricity through it and partly disabled the functionality. So why would you do that, considering if the chip is less useful, you can expect to get less money for it in the market than if it was more useful? Well, it's very simple. It's called price discrimination, and they wanted to capture more customers, but they needed, for purposes of profit maximization, to get more money from the richer customers, those who could afford to pay more, and also sell a product to other customers who didn't have so much money to spend. How do they do this? They have two products. One is the top-of-the-range product that they charge more for, and one is the substandard product that they make by destroying functionality of the good product. So they're actually paying money to destroy their own product, and the economic system is rewarding them for doing that, saying, yes, you deserve to have a larger income because what you're doing is more productive. So this is a test that you can use to apply to new economic systems. Does it reward people for destroying their own property? And if the answer is yes, then this doesn't seem like a very promising basis for a new economy. So some economic systems, such as LETs, community currencies, are definitely a step forward, a step away from the pyramid Ponzi scheme that we've been learning about, the global economy. But nevertheless, because they're based on a model of what can I get, then they do reward destruction of your own property. And don't think this is only limited to CPUs. This is a very widespread phenomenon. The only system that I came up with which passed this test was that of a gift economy, where you're asking yourself, what can I do to improve somebody else's well-being? How much can I give another person? And under that question, there's never an advantage for destroying functionality. So that's a system that promotes abundance. It doesn't reward people who create scarcity where abundance already exists. Now we're going to have an interview I found on radioforall.net by Janie Reznor from a series called Women's Voices. She's interviewing Genevieve Vaughan, who is a long-standing gift economy activist, and she starts the interview with a song that's written and performed by Genevieve Vaughan, We're Walking in a Circle.
We are walking in a circle. We are walking hand in hand. We are walking in a circle to create the promised land. We are loving one another. We are crossing the divide. We are walking with our mother and our sisters by our side. We're a circle in a spiral that's evolving towards the light. We're a bridge between the sunshine and the everlasting night. We are women of all nations. We are straight and we are gay, liberating generations at the dawn of a new day. We are dancing in a circle. We are dancing all around. We are dancing in a circle to create a higher ground. We're embracing one another as we're spinning round the sun. And we love Earth, our mother, and all creation. We are walking in a circle. We are walking hand in hand. We are walking in a circle to create the promised land, to create the promised land.
That beautiful, profound, and visionary song heralding a new day was created and performed by my guest, author, and independent researcher, Genevieve Vaughan. I believe the lyrics tell a great deal about her. From the introduction to her book, The Gift, A Feminist Analysis, Genevieve writes, "Gift-giving exists in many places, but it is made invisible by patriarchal capitalism. Two basic economic paradigms coexist in the world today. They are logically contradictory, but also complementary. One is visible, the other invisible. One highly valued, the other undervalued. One is connected with men, the other with women. What we need to do is validate the one connected with women, causing a basic shift in the values by which we direct our lives and policies. The present economic system, which is made to seem natural and too widespread to change, is based upon a simple operation in which individuals participate at many different levels and at many different times. This operation is exchange, which can be described as giving in order to receive. The motivation is self-oriented, since what is given returns under a different form to the giver or to satisfy her or his need. The satisfaction of the need of the other person is a means to the satisfaction of one's own need. Exchange requires identification of the things exchanged, as well as their measurement, and assertion of their equivalence to the satisfaction of the exchangers, that neither is giving more than she or he is receiving. It therefore requires visibility, attracting attention, even though it is done so often that the visibility is commonplace. Money enters the exchange, taking the place of products, reflecting their quantitative evaluation. This seemingly simple human interaction of exchange, since it is done so often, becomes a sort of archetype or magnet for other human interactions, making itself and whatever looks like it seem normal, while anything else is crazy. For example, we talk about exchanges of love, conversations, glances, favors, ideas. Since there is an equivalence asserted between what we give and what we receive, it seems that whoever has a lot, has produced a lot, or given a lot, and is, therefore, somehow more than whoever has less. Exchange puts the ego first and allows it to grow and develop in ways that emphasize me first, competitive and hierarchical behavior patterns. This ego is not an intrinsic part of the human being, but is a social product coming from the kinds of human interaction it is involved in. The alternative paradigm, which is hidden, or at least misidentified, is nurturing and generally other-oriented. Genevieve Vaughn is an independent researcher who was born in Texas and presently lives in Italy, and who has given vast amounts of money away to women to further the work of social change. She has been working on the theory of a maternal gift economy as an alternative to patriarchal capitalism for many years. Vaughn's book, Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange, and two edited books, The Gift, A Feminist Analysis, and Women and the Gift Economy, A Radically Different Worldview is Possible, her ebook, Homos Donans, two children's books, Mother Nature's Children and Free, Not Free, her CD, which we heard the first cut of, Songs for the Tree of Life, and a film on her life, Giving for Giving, and her many articles are available free at her website, www.gift-economy.com. In the past year, Genevieve has presented talks in St. Poulton and Graz, Austria, and was the keynote speaker in Ireland at the Trinity University Conference on Mercy versus Sacrifice, and the keynote speaker at the National Women's Studies Conference in Finland at the University of Oulu. Together with several others in the group International Feminists for a Gift Economy, she gave two panels in Nairobi at the World Social Forum in January. She has spoken at a number of semiotics conferences, I'll get correction from her soon, I'm sure, in Italy and Finland. She recently presented her paper, Making Unilateral Gift Giving Visible, on a panel on the gift economy at the American Association of Anthropology in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Genevieve.
Thank you so much, Janie. That's quite an introduction.
It is. And at last you get to speak. I'm so delighted to have you as my guest, and I know our listening audience is too.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be on your show.
You know, the first question I usually ask my guests is, how did your own mother influence you to become the woman that you are today?